Welcome to our 37th lesson in the book of Romans. I've entitled it, Work Stumbles Over Grace. I want to start off looking at these three salient points from last week's lesson, that God has innate authority over mankind. Not that mankind loves us, mankind hates it. All sinners hate the authority of God, that's the bad. Paul began his whole argument in Romans 1:18 by showing that all people are conceived in sin and thus are asabei, are ungodly, hate God, want no knowledge of God, substitute their own knowledge, their own truth for God's absolute truth, and thus live in ignorance and darkness willingly, so they do not have to acknowledge God. And yet, though this makes everyone worthy of going to the lake of fire because they are sinful, we are all sinful, God has elected, based solely on a criteria that he has not revealed to anyone else, he has elected some for life. Does this make him unrighteous? And of course, this was what we discussed last week. No, it does not. It makes him very righteous that he would share his righteousness with some. Why not with all? Because all means that no one changes. It means that God cannot have a standard of right and wrong. Why do we not, in our own infinite wisdom within our own lands, make our laws of non-effect by saying it doesn't matter what you do, you will be absolved of any guilt of any crime? Just how well do you think that's going to go for having peace and harmony? That's not. You're going to have survival of the fittest. You're going to have murder on every block because there's no consequence. Remember, the death penalty does not deter crime. It is a consequence to remove those elements that are too dangerous to remain in society. There is no such thing as a deterrent for the sinner. It's only about me and what I can get away with. So if I think I can get away with stuff, I would do that. And this is what we do. But the laws bring punishment. But if we say that the laws do not matter, then what's the point? There is no fear. There's just only crime. There's only sin. And God says there must be order. I am a God of order. I am a God of righteousness. Righteousness is nothing more than his character that defines what is right. And what he does not define as right is automatically wrong. Thus, these vessels of wrath are showing much patience because God does not eliminate them immediately. Otherwise, we'd all be eliminated at conception. There'd be nobody to save. But they are exposed to the truth, and they compound their guilt by rejecting it. Yes, this magnifies his glory and mercies revealed in those whom he has saved, both from Jews and Gentiles. Remember the parable of the laborers that we talked about? That it was reminiscent of Christ. It was a metaphor for Christ and those whom he has called to salvation, that he goes and he... People are sent out into the vineyard early in the day, midday, noon, mid-afternoon, early evening, and then he gives them all the same wage because there's only one salvation. There's not various degrees of salvation. The Jews wanted different degrees of salvation. Them being at the top, of course, because they had the law. But the Gentiles, they didn't have law. They weren't the dogs, so... They're lucky they got anything. that was their whole opinion, and you can read it, the Talmud, and it's in there. And even today, those who follow the Talmud and the Midrash and the Mishnah, it's in there even today. And it would shock most people to know that. And yet God, firmly but gently, calling him friend, showing there was a relationship. And there always was a relationship between God and the Jews. Even today, those whom he has hidden, not the Jews that are parading around in their own nation, those are not the ones called forth. God has not called forth his true Jews yet. It's not their time yet. And we'll talk about this in a moment when we get to Habakkuk. But he's going to call out his Jews. And they're going to go forth and do his will. But there is only that one salvation. And God said, friend, can I not do with what I want with what is mine? And of course he can, because he's creator. And finally, the lost seek to infiltrate it into God's salvation without having the changed nature. Last thing they want is to be changed. Last thing I ever wanted when I was lost was to be saved. I didn't want to change nature. I just want damn solution so I could continue doing what I was doing, being miserable. Well, we get back to our lesson in Romans chapter 9, starting in verse 27. Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will be saved. The Lord will carry out his sentence upon the earth fully and without delay. So ever since the 8th century B.C., the Jews were told that only a remnant of their nation would be saved. Of course, this comes from Isaiah chapter 10, verse 22. Now, the Sadducees and Pharisees believed that they were the remnant to be saved because they were smart, they were intellectual, they were in a position of power, they had wealth, and God only likes those who are smart, powerful, and wealthy. Which meant that the greater part of the population were without hope and were considered too ignorant and stupid to be trainable. And we get this from John 7, verses 32 and then 45 through 49. Where these words actually fall out of the mouths of the Sadducees, that'd be the priesthood, and the Pharisees, that would be the Talmudic philosophers and law keepers, the greater number, I might add. And that is the Judaism that has survived down to today, is the Talmudic Pharisees. Somebody calls themselves a religious Jew, that's what they're pursuing, is Phariseeism. Sadducees became a nothing, like smoke in the mist, on a breeze, once the temple was destroyed. They basically passed off the scene. So this is a classic trap of legalism, of saying that you are the measure of all things. It's always about you, because that's what sin does. It's about me. It's always about me. Never about you. You might think it's about you, but I'm going to eliminate you. So it's only about you if you support me, and then I might share with you as long as it makes me better than you. And thus, where's wars and fighting's come? Yep. And this whole attitude. Now, the true measure of righteousness, though, is Christ, whom God made to be sin, though he had knew no sin, to purchase righteousness for those without hope. Now, Isaiah is using a technical term here, sand of the sea. If you're a New Testament Christian and you're not reading much in the Old Testament, you're going to skip this and miss it. But this is going to run from Genesis to Revelation just to understand this term. Because that's where it's at, from Genesis to Revelation. And we first see this in Genesis 22. Well, we're going to go to Genesis 22. So it's the first time we see it. But we see both of these promises together. And so it'll just be quicker for us to do this. So Genesis 22, starting in verse 17, I will surely bless you, says God, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven, as the sand of the sea that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. Now notice, when we get to verse 18, we're not saying which offspring. And if you're not a careful reader, you're going to think God means both. Now, there is going to be a both, but it's beyond the scope of our lesson here to delve into to depth in this. But just so you know that what God is referring to here primarily is the stars of the heaven. So who were the sand of the seas? These are ones who are not going to be saved. Now, your first thought would come to mind. That would be Ishmael, whose offspring would be the sand of the sea, because he was the son of the slave Hagar. And Paul used them as metaphor in Galatians 4, 21 through 31, to show that they were of slavery, they were trapped in their sin, just like earthly Jerusalem in Paul's day was trapped in the sin of legalism and thus was promoting slavery. Slavery to the law which could not save, because the law can only condemn. Whereas Sarah and Isaac were metaphors for the promise of God, which is a metaphor for the new Jerusalem above in heaven. Thus, this is the first time we read of it in the scripture. And Paul saw this in his vision. That's why he knew it existed. Nobody else did. Thus, they couldn't write about it. You don't write about what you don't know. Because you don't know what you don't know. Otherwise, you would know it. But Paul knew it, so he wrote about it. And this is a metaphor for those who are saved. Excuse me. That would be as the stars of the heaven and represent those who live by faith. So let's go to Hosea, chapter 1. We're going to come back here again. But here, God is using Hosea and he is telling him to go take a wife who's going to be unfaithful. Now, Hosea is a priest, so he can't marry a prostitute directly. So he marries a woman, but God says, you know, she's going to be unfaithful. She's going to leave you. And sure enough, she does. She goes, as part of, sells herself to be a prostitute. He has to go and buy her back, and he brings her home. And this was all a metaphor for Israel, the northern kingdom, and how they played the harlot with God. And God goes into detail in Hosea chapter 2. But what he does is use Hosea's children as metaphors to testify against the people of Israel, the northern kingdom. And so their first child, God has her name, called his name Jezreel. For on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And then later on she conceived a daughter. He said, call her No Mercy. For I will have no mercy on the house of Israel. And then when she conceived again and bore a son, the Lord said, call his name, not my people, for you are not my people. I am not your God. Thus, all those who would be as the sand on the seashore would not be his people. In verse 10, he says, yet though the number of the children of Israel should be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered, he says, I'm going to show them mercy. I'm going to make them my people. So what I'm saying here is that God has informed Israel the entire nation, northern and southern kingdoms, because what he wrote to the north is later on going to apply to the south when they run off and do exactly the same thing. That though you are acting in an idolatrous manner, you are rejecting me. At some point, I will come back for you. But for all those who reject him, they have to pay for that rejection. And of course, the northern kingdom represented those who were as the sand of the sea, because they embraced idolatry since the day of their rebellion to the day of their destruction and beyond. In fact, if you go to 2 Kings chapter 17, read verses 7 through 18, you're going to read a short synopsis of the history. Ever since the day that the northern kingdom rebelled, and of course God hates rebellion, broke away from Judah, they established idolatry, both in the northern part of the kingdom, which had been there since nearly the time they had entered the land as conquerors, because that's where the tribe of Dan migrated to and set up their own idols. And they also set up a calf worship in the southern part of northern Israel to keep the people from returning to Jerusalem three times a year, like they were supposed to, and thus eventually reuniting the kingdoms. So they were built on idolatry. There was no king of the north that was ever called good, and God eventually sent them away into captivity and did not call them back. And so not only does this apply to Ishmael and Isaac, but it also applies to Jacob. Now, from the northern kingdom, the top echelon were carried off into captivity. Thus, that's left the bulk of the population, which is poor and infirm and worthless, left in the land. They were never the 10 lost tribes. That was a romantic notion that was never based in history. It was just based in conjecture. But the Assyrians did bring other peoples into the land to populate it and control it and stuff. Now we know that their priests that they had were idolatrous, but wild animals populated the land, they were decimating the population, so King of Assyria was told, well, you need to bring their priests back so that they can teach people how to appease them, and thus the wild beasts will go away. And that's what the King of Assyria did. He brought back several of the priests that were already idolatrous. They were half idolatrous and half of God. which really makes them idolatrous. And they reinforce this false view of God, and later on this became known as Samaria, and they became known as Samaritans. And thus, they built their temple during the intertestament period on Mount Gerizim, which Judah later on destroyed because they were just that kind of people. Yet we see that this is the sand of the sea. This is the remnant of Jacob. Children. That were going to die in their sins. They rejected God. In fact, in Genesis 32, God tells him, but you said, this is Jacob talking, referring to God, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Now he said this while he sent his family and servants and slaves and property and all this ahead in groups to go to meet Esau, because he knew he wronged Esau. He knew Esau was fully justified in executing him because Esau was more honorable than he was, and he had stolen the tribal leadership, the promise. And he lived in mortal fear of Esau for over 20 years. Now he's going back, he's going to meet him, and Esau is coming to meet him. And he's just going to sacrifice everybody and everything to save his skin, even his kids and wives. You just go run ahead and meet him, and maybe he'll get tired of killing before he gets to me, and it'll be okay. This is the mentality of a lost person. Jacob is not saved at this point. But he meets Christ on the riverbank that night, and he wrestles all night because he is in mortal fear. And God illuminates him, and he says, bless me. God blesses him, but weakens him. And changes his name to Israel. That was Jacob's come to Jesus moment too. But many of his children were taught idolatrous ways. And we see this never left them. Indeed, why should it? Because they're all conceived in sin, just like all of us were, and they want nothing to do with God. They have to want to have something to do with God, but that only happens when God comes to you, like Jacob here on the seashore, on the river shore. He's wrestling. He's petrified. And yet, he's blessed because he's now saved. And thus, those who are the stars of the heavens represent those who live by faith. Now, to understand this, we have to go to Habakkuk. One through four. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets so he may run who reads it, for still the vision waits for its appointed time and hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. The righteous shall live by his faith. Give you a little background on this. Habakkuk was lamenting that Judah was so terrible. Now, they had already seen the northern kingdom Israel get carried off into captivity and not come back. And yet, they didn't learn much. And Habakkuk is mourning that they didn't learn much. He's religious. So he asked God, why aren't you punishing this kingdom? Like, you're not a part of the kingdom. Come on. And this is the view of a self-righteous sinner. Why are you not punishing them? You're going to have to punish me because I'm already good. That's why I'm talking to you. God has to correct them. And say, well, we're going to bring Babylon up here, and you guys going off captivity for a while. You're not going to stay, but for a while. And Habakkuk is just beside him, so he's just trotting. How can you do this? They're wicked, they're evil, they're sinful. Well, you know, whenever God uses any people, he's always using sinners. There are no non-sinners. And if you think just because you're saved that you're not righteous, you're not. You're still a sinner. If you're righteous, it's because you're covered in Christ's righteousness. And we're not even deserving of that. That's why it's of grace and not of works. Because works is just multiplying our own self-righteousness, making our plight even worse. But Habakkuk is now going to have a come-to-Jesus moment. He says, I'm going to stand here and let God correct me. This is not a mark of a sinner. This is a mark of somebody who now has a new nature, a new heart. They don't have a new nature yet. They don't have the new covenant in the Old Testament. But in some form or fashion, we know they do have a new heart. We get this from 1 Samuel 16, when God gave Saul a new heart when he turned to leave Samuel after Samuel prophesied that he was going to be the king of Israel. And that's what all that we can say is that Old Testament salvation is still based on faith. And this is exactly what Habakkuk is going to say. God is going to fulfill his word. You're going to run, but you can still read it because it's written down. It's not going to come before its appointed time. It's not going to come after its appointed time. It will come. It will not delay. It will occur when it's supposed to occur. And you have to live by faith. Anything else is sin. And so from about the 6th century B.C. onward, anyone reading these words knew you had to live by faith. But most did not. Most were still living by works, by law. Now Judah was carried off in three successive waves and came back in three successive waves, and there's a reason for that. Yet even during these deportations, the elite of Judah continued their idolatry, even within the precincts of the temple itself as revealed by Ezekiel. And you go to Ezekiel chapter 8, and God shows that though the priests and the elders try to hide their sin from the people within the inner sanctums of the temple. They had idolatrous inner temples. And women were weeping near the altar, first of all, where they shouldn't have been, because they were outside the court of the women. But they were weeping for Tammuz, an annual idolatrous ceremony. But they weren't weeping